Good morning and welcome. I'm Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to welcome you here today. Welcome you if you're in the room or if you're watching on the live stream or C-SPAN, or even if you're watching later the video. But welcome in and thank you for being here. Welcome as we mark the 40th anniversary of the Federalist Society. And I say the word mark purposely, advisedly, rather than celebrate. I think some celebration is appropriate. Applause is appropriate. Thank you for that. But I'm personally less interested in pats on the back and accolades. I'm personally more interested in looking to the future. And indeed, my prediction as a veteran of the Federalist Society is that the Federalist Society is poised to accomplish more in the next 10 years than it has in the past 40 years. But that depends on you. Not only is this organization yours, you are the organization, in my humble analysis. You are the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is nothing more than its volunteer leadership and membership. Well, maybe the donors too. The donors the donors are important. And you know, we're a nonprofit organization and we're very good at being a nonprofit organization. So the donors are important. But the theme for this year's convention is particularly topical, I think, the current state of the legal profession. Now, of course, our profession is, should be, an example to the rest of the country. Our adversarial system, the idea that matters are debatable, that debate leads to truth. Our profession should be held out, heralded as an example. I'm not claiming that attorneys are held in lofty esteem by our fellow Americans. In fact, I really like the snarky line that it's the unprincipled and disreputable 98% of the lawyers that are ruining it for the rest of us. But to get to the business of the convention, we have a first-class event, series of events over the next 3 days. And that, of course, the phrase first class reminds me of a brief story that I've told once before, but somebody asked me to reiterate this story on the first class. So this story goes back to my early days, my early career, and concerns two back-to-back business trips I was taking. Even though it was beginning of my career, there were airlines, there were airplanes, air travel was involved, I was working for the federal government. And because of travel complications, my return flight on my first trip landed at Dulles Airport after midnight. I went home for a few hours of sleep. I had the first flight out the next morning across the country to California. So in the morning, I went back to the airport, still dark outside, standing in line at the check-in counter, looking ahead. I was flying on a budget rate, cut rate, no-frills sort of startup airline. Doesn't exist anymore, I'm sure. Trying to save taxpayer dollars. And as I got to the front of the line, I could see the very eager young man, looked like a teenager to me, even though I was young, behind the counter, dressed in these bright company colors like a fast food restaurant employee. And as I approached, he looked at me and he said, and I'm not kidding, he said, is this your first time flying? You know, I was young, but I was dressed like a businessman and had a carry-on bag. And because I had landed earlier that very morning at Dulles Airport, I was able to respond, this isn't my first time flying today. But that went straight over his head. He didn't know what that... but I assume he meant to ask me if this is my first time flying on that airline. But anyhow, I was booked in steerage way in the back of the plane, probably what at that point in time was a smoking section, maybe even, if you folks can remember that. And I was thinking about upgrading to first class, even though I was making a paltry amount of money, I'd have to do it at my own expense. So I said to this young man, do you have any first class seats available? I was hopeful, I had my fingers crossed. And the young, to his credit, he looked me straight in the eye and he said, sir, all our seats are first class. I said, of course they are, and I just trudged off to my flight. But at this convention, it really will be first class, I promise you that. So a couple of very quick housekeeping things, and then we'll get to our opening address. Please use the QR code. It's been circulated. If you want CLE credit, you need to check in every day with the QR code to get that CLE credit. If you don't sign in, you won't get credit. When you leave, you need to check out, sign out with the CLE credit, with the QRO code. Otherwise, by this time next week, you'll be claiming with your bar 170 hours of credit, and they will deny you. I want to take one moment to thank the Jack Miller Center for sponsoring something new at the convention this year, a rare documents exhibit, and the Remnant Trust for bringing it here for your viewing. It's in the South Carolina room upstairs on the second floor for the duration of the convention, but don't wait too long to go see it. There you can see, and in some instances even hold, original copies of Blackstone commentaries, the 1787 pamphlet of the U.S. Constitution, a first edition of the Federalist Papers, the first official publication of the U.S. Bill of Rights, the 1776 edition of Thomas Paine's Common Sense, and much, much more. So that's the South Carolina room upstairs. Trust me, you're going to love it. If you drop your business card there, you can win this. This is a leaf out of the Federalist Papers. This is Federalist 46, an original first edition with the front and back of the page, very handsome. We've never done a drawing at the Federalist Society. It's not really our kind of thing, but we've also never had a leaf of the Federalist Papers first edition. So I'm looking forward to that. Now, turning back to the business of the convention, for our opening address, we've recruited a longtime Federalist Society leader, someone who can speak to the 40 years of the organization from beginning to this moment, as it has thrived. He asked me to be brief in my introduction, so I will, and I'm helped by the fact that you already know him. Chief Judge William Bill Pryor sits on the 11th Circuit for now nearing 20 years. Importantly, he started and then ran the Tulane Law School chapter of the Federalist Society while he was there. The first time Tulane had a chapter, please. He was then a clerk for Judge John Minor Wisdom on the 5th Circuit. He served first as deputy and then as the Alabama Attorney General for years. You might not know that he served on the U.S. Sentencing Commission for years. He's, of course, been in private practice, and he's taught at various law schools. I would say if it touches the law, he's pretty much been there. And if it concerns the Federalist Society, he's pretty much done that. So please welcome me in joining, please join me in welcoming Chief Judge Pryor.
Good morning. Dean, thank you for that kind introduction. It is a pleasure to be here with you and with this great society. As always, I'm looking forward to the addresses, debates, and discussions for this annual convention. This year, we celebrate an important anniversary, as Dean mentioned. 40 years ago, Stephen Calabrese, who was a law student at Yale University, planned with his friends Lee Lieberman and David McIntosh, who were law students at the University of Chicago, a three-day symposium in New Haven on an academic topic, Federalism, Legal and Political Ramifications. Among the speakers for that symposium were Robert Bork, Antonin Scalia, and Ted Olson. President Reagan appointed Bork and Scalia to serve as judges on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit that same year. Ted Olson already served in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. About 200 people attended the symposium, and so began the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. What started as an organization for law students grew quickly. For my part, I arrived as a first-year student at Tulane Law School in the fall of 1984, 2 years after the Society's first symposium. At the orientation for first-year students, representatives of all the student organizations spoke and encouraged us to become involved in extracurricular activities. Now, most of the student groups, like the Law Review or the Student Bar Association, had no overt ideological agenda. But one student group clearly did. The president of the new chapter of the National Lawyers Guild explained its history as a liberal counterweight to what he called the Conservative American Bar Association. That presentation made me think that perhaps Tulane needed a new student organization dedicated to traditional Anglo-American ideas about the rule of law. Of course, there was no internet to search yet. None of us students could yet afford personal computers, nor did we have cell phones. But William F. Buckley Jr. was publishing National Review, which had covered the formation of the Federalist Society. I searched my several back issues and found an advertisement for the Society with a phone number for an office in Washington, D.C. I called the number, which in those days was a big deal for a poor law student on a tight budget because the call was long distance. The Society's first and then only employee, Eugene Meyer, answered the call. With his guidance, I worked soon afterward with another student to plan our first event at Tulane. And similar efforts happened all over the country. Today, the Federalist Society sponsors thousands of programs with tens of thousands of participants and attendees. It has chapters at more than 200 American law schools with more than 10,000 student members, and annually host a national symposium for hundreds of students, law professors, judges, public officials, and policy experts. It has chapters for lawyers in about 100 cities with more than 65,000 members. And it has a faculty division that sponsors programs for current and aspiring law professors. For decades, it has held this National Lawyers Convention in our nation's capital. We have a lot to celebrate. What is our mission? Named for the founders who favored the ratification of our Constitution and sporting a logo with the bust of the father of the Constitution, James Madison, the Society is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. And through its programs, publications, videos, and podcasts, it seeks to promote an awareness of these principles and to further their application. Now, from the start, the Federalist Society has promoted rigorous and open debate as the best way to ensure that the founding principles of our Constitution receive a fair hearing. And the results speak for themselves. Once again, thousands of lawyers, judges, academics, public officials, and students have gathered for this convention to hear public speeches and debates about the rule of law covered by a free press. In many ways, it's as if we're holding the Yale Symposium again for a bigger crowd at a fancier venue with better food. On the surface, at least, not much else has changed. But on this happy occasion, I must ask, is there more to this story? Are we ready to consider the tough questions? Do we care about debate as we say we do? If so, what do the critics say? Is there more to the Federalist Society than meets the eye? What do we really do? After 40 years, I decided it was time to look harder and investigate the secretive and mysterious network that critics charge has captured the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court of the United States. So I researched the topic, an odyssey itself, and what I found exceeded even my wildest expectations. I quickly discovered that I should not waste my time attending the thousands of public events at the hundreds of student and lawyers' chapters across the country, nor should I bother with the many volumes of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, the back issues of Engage or Federalist Society Review, the YouTube videos and podcasts, or the pages of information on the Society website. The critics explain that the public operation provides only camouflage. As the writers at Slate, Dahlia Lithwick and Rick Hasson, explain, The Federalist Society has, quote, styled itself a debating society long after it ceased to be anything of the sort. And as intellectual luminary Ellie Mistel has said, usually FedSoc is able to operate in relative anonymity, quietly working to destroy the equal protection rights of women and minorities, end quote. So to get to the truth, I had to go to the shadows, where the real operation of this society happens. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, there we go. My odyssey began by consulting the work of a longtime critic, a leader of the world's greatest deliberative body, the United States Senate, toiling away there, doing deep, thoughtful, and insightful research, has been a former federal prosecutor, my former colleague as a state attorney general, an elite lawyer and seasoned investigator. I speak, of course, of Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. We decided to meet at a private beach club, or as he calls it, a long tradition on the coast of Rhode Island, where he insisted we would find no FedSoc operatives in the shadows. Truth be told, what Senator Whitehouse has discovered is more startling than anything I could have ever imagined. According to Senator Whitehouse, for years, quote, dark money operatives working from the shadows have installed Supreme Court justices handpicked by the minions of far-right donors, end quote. Little did I know that millions of American voters, the past presidents of the United States, and United States senators only provided camouflage for the real operation. And at the center of that stealth operation has been a reclusive leader of this society, the co-chair of the board of directors, Leonard Leo. As Senator Whitehouse puts it, Leonard Leo is the little spider that you find at the center of the dark money web. His spider web extends to state courts, city councils, and even local schools to subvert democracy with dark money. Now, Senator Whitehouse has also explained that all of you in attendance for this convention have one thing in common. You, quote, all know Leonard, and he knows all of you. As commentator Tripp Brennan of BlueTint.us puts it, if dark money conservative groups, quote, represent the Death Star of the conservative legal movement, Leonard Leo is Darth Vader and the Emperor rolled into one. The Senate Democratic Policy and Communications Committee has even provided an illustration of the spider web to identify all the power players in the society. This illustration helps you understand how the power players do the real work in the shadows. Let's take a look. I start with what the critics call the ideological brain trust, the academics. Although many doubt the influence of contemporary legal scholarship on American law, I say to the brain trust, don't worry, your place is secure. As Senator Whitehouse explains, quote, if you are out to deconstruct American law and replace it with what the big donors want, you need some intellectual weaponry. You don't just need justices who will do what you ask. You need legal theories. You need to give the justices you put on the court the intellectual artillery, the demolition theories that will help them destroy the precedents and deconstruct our legal system, end quote. You need the brain trust to, quote, systematically cheerlead for cultivated fringe ideas. And for those young or aspiring law professors worried about a topic for your next law review article, I say, be not afraid. Senator Whitehouse explains, quote, the legal theories are easy to come up with. You, You reverse engineer. You start with what big donor interest wants, then work backwards. Aha. So there you have it. You need legal theories, intellectual artillery, to deconstruct our legal system. But these intellectual theories are easy to come up with through reverse engineering. Everybody got that? Let's next turn to the law clerks and the students. Now, if you're new to the Federalist Society or find its mission statement obscure, worry not. One of the great journalists of our time at a venerable institution for investigative journalism. I speak, of course, of Joe Patrice at Above the Law, has distilled the work of the Society into three steps. Three steps. First, lay the pseudo-academic table for the MAGA movement. You heard that right. The pseudo-academic table for the MAGA movement, whatever that means. Second, recruit students to indulge their trollish impulses while placing them on greased rails to the federal bench. That sounds painful. Regardless of actual qualifications, end quote. And third, now most of all, this most important of all, this is key, quote, serve Chick-fil-A. I suspect many of the law students here today are here for one thing, the food. As Vox.com reports, students and faculty, quote, always attend the Federalist Society events because they have the best food and the best alcohol. So students and law clerks, have a great weekend and enjoy the food. For the students in attendance dreaming of becoming judges, in the past, I would have advised you to study hard, get good grades, become an editor of the Law Review, get a clerkship to start your career, practice at a law firm, and perform public service. But Catherine Rubino at Above the Law tells us that thanks to this society, quote, ideological purity and pursuit of a far-right agenda is the single most important bona fide for conservative nominees. And no less an authority than Mark Joseph Stern. And really, is there less an authority? Has explained, Federalist Society judges tend to hire Federalist Society clerks, and the conservative legal movement's radicalization machine produces an endless line of young lawyers even more extreme than their predecessors. Over the past half century, each generation of conservative attorneys, particularly those with judicial ambition, has become more radical than the last. Now to the finest product of the radicalization machine, my people, the judges. Now judges, if you're wearing a hearing aid, you might want to turn it up because Senator Whitehouse says that although money talks, dark money whispers. Dahlia Lithwick and Rick Hassan at Slate helpfully explain that the quote, ostensible neutrality of the Federalist Society provides cover so that sitting judges and Supreme Court justices can speak at Federalist Society events and use the network to recruit judicial clerks who can come into the pipeline to help further conservative ideas without running afoul of rules barring judges from engaging in partisan political activities, end quote. They say it's also a showcase to vet and prep future judges. So if I understand them right, the Federalist Society is like a combined lecture circuit and career placement service for, say, a law school. But ostensible neutrality? I think they might have us confused with Yale. I'll ask Judge Ho. What about the educational program? Ms. Rubino at Above the Law explains that recent decisions by the Supreme Court on abortion, the Establishment Clause, the Second Amendment, and the administrative state have created a, quote, hellscape that can be laid directly on the doorstep of FedSoc. So, if you're a judge, this convention offers you a unique educational opportunity. to get ahead of the curve and to start work on the sequel, Hellscape 2. Of course, not all critics of the society are on the left. Consider, for example, Harvard Law professor Adrian Vermeule, who recently published an op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, "There is no conservative legal movement." There is no conservative legal movement. What a coincidence to run all into all of you here this morning. For the last few years, Professor Vermeule has been composing a requiem for what he calls Originalism, Inc., and touting, quote, a better originalism that he calls common good constitutionalism, or what I call living common goodism. You might have heard, I'm a skeptic. But after reading Professor Vermeule's op-ed and watching the recent term of the Supreme Court, Gene Meyer probably feels a bit like President Truman holding the newspaper with the headline, "Dewey Defeats Truman." If you're a practitioner, especially at the Supreme Court, you might not recognize One First Street the next time you visit, because Rakeem Brooks of Democracy Docket warns that FedSoc has sought to make the federal courts unrecognizable, and in just one Supreme Court term seems to have accomplished that feat. Perhaps we should hold the convention there next year. But no, the rooms are too small, and the food is better here. Besides, we could never leave the Mayflower Hotel. Too many special memories at this grand old hotel. For those of you who are attending the convention for the first time, the critics also have special insights about this event. Jay Willis of ballsandstrikes.org helpfully calls this annual convention, quote, a three-day festival of conservative legal movement luminaries explaining that the correct schools of jurisprudential thought are those that yield the conservative legal movement's preferred policy outcomes. He describes the society as, quote, one of the most powerful reactionary forces in the legal universe, which he grudgingly admits, quote, makes the participation of many non-reactionaries in its fancy events equal parts baffling and alarming. A more objective source, Professor Stephen Tellis, describes the society as a network to give conservatives a chance to meet one another and check one another out. His words. Now, I suspect many of you have been looking forward to checking each other out. Perhaps now is a good time to announce the launch of the new FedSoc dating app. Swipe right. My law clerks assembled up here are excited about its release this week. I hear that next year FedSoc will launch another dating app for the National Student Symposium. They're going to call it Legal Tinder. Tonight, of course, the Society will hold its annual Antonin Scalia Memorial Dinner, or what Vox.com describes as like a ball for the who's who in the conservative legal movement. There we go. I guess we're like Baptists, though, because we don't dance. We just dress up and, of course, eat great food and drink. Lisa Ezell tells me that about 2,000 people, a record, have tickets for the dinner. In fact, we're sold out. So for those of you who made the cut, congratulations. Tonight, take a selfie. Post it on social media. Put it on the firm bio. It's official. You're now listed in who's who in the conservative legal movement. For those of you still on the waiting list, keep trying. And better luck next year. To sum things up, per Vox.com, quote, you could make a real case that the Federalist Society is the single most influential advocacy organization in Washington right now, and its story began with a small startup grant from the Olin Foundation. After all, It's just another way America's philanthropic system, in which rich donors get lavish tax breaks for donations that can, if used properly, profound alter public policy, can clash with norms of democracy, end quote. I don't know about you, but I would call a student group beginning with a small grant for an academic conference and growing into one of the most influential organizations in the United States, promoting the Constitution and the rule of law, an organizational example of the American dream. May God bless America, and may God bless the Federalist Society. Enjoy the food.